All right. So basically today, it's all up to you guys to ask some questions. We might be able to wander with some topics for a bit if no one has any questions to ask. But hopefully you do. Does anyone have any questions? Maybe from past quizzes, things you're not comfortable with currently. Yes.
Can you go over buffer overflow attack?
Sure. So, the main example actually might be right here. So, main deal behind buffer overflow attacks are we have some buffer here, charC, which is only of size 12, but then we are inserting something into that buffer, but not checking exactly how much we are inserting. So here we're inserting strlen of bar into C, but who knows how long bar is. So if it's longer than 12 characters, then this is going to overflow this buffer. So looking at this picture, if you take 61, you'll get much more familiar with this sort of layout and actually dealing with the saved frame pointer and return address and parent routine sec and all these actual things. But here you just need to know that we have this little space for our buffer. So here we have C0, then we have like C1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. But under normal circumstances, we would fill this buffer as per usual. We would put, like if we inserted hello, we'd have like H-E-L-L-O backslash 0, and then just a bunch of empty space. But for a hacker, oh, I guess this is the example. For a hacker, we get something like this, where what they're specifically trying to do is usually override the return address. So whenever you call a function, a new stack frame gets pushed onto the stack. That stack frame needs to know how, or well, the function that has been called needs to know how to return to the function that called it. So if main calls foo, foo needs to return to main. And so that's what this return address does. But what the hacker's going to do is override it with a special return address, where, again, little endian, so it's not straightforward, but each byte is backwards. So this return address, as far as the computer is concerned, returning to this address is equivalent to returning to foo or main or whatever function called it. So it's going to return to this address, which just so happens to be this address, which either sometimes what they do here is use the return address of like a specific function that they know is already there. So I can't remember what the function's called. I'll look it up later. But here, what they're doing is passing the return address to the stack itself. And this is somewhat strange, where there are examples of memory where like memory can be split up into like read-only, read-write, and executable memory, where we have seen read-only memory before, where like if I say char star s equals hello, I can't modify hello. That's read-only memory. So there's also this idea of executable memory, where the executable memory would be the text segment of your code. So looking at your usual address space layout. So let's, hopefully that's going to get me a good picture. Yeah, so this works. Where we have our stack up here, we have data memory, this is all, ignore this basically, this is our heap, and then we have down here our main program code. So this is similar to the place where we put our strings like char star s equals hello, in that it's read only. But you could also mark this main program code as executable. And if you are doing that or your operating system does that correctly, then this should be the only place in memory that code can actually execute. Which means that this sort of buffer overflow attack we have over here would be ineffective, because this is trying to execute memory up here in our stack. So notice the picture is reversed. We have our stack kind of growing up. Here the stack is growing down. For CS50 purposes, the stack grows up. So it is possible to circumvent this particular type of buffer overflow by having these executable regions of memory and non-executable regions. But it just so happens that rarely is executable memory marked as executable. It just tends to be read-only and rewrite are the only things that are used. So this is still very effective. And here we can put whatever we want here. So it wasn't actually done as a PSET in 61 this year, but if you look at like last year's offering of it or any previous year, one PSET is you are specifically supposed to insert in here code that is supposed to like print some specific value or return a value that is different from the value that is supposed to be printed. Or even more cleverly, it wants you to call or write, or so this will return up to here, and then you'll execute some code in here, and the cleverest of overflows will then return to what this return address used to be. So even though we needed to override this to come up here, we still remember that return address somewhere so that we can return to main or whatever, and it's like we never even noticed that things went wrong, but things did. So that's the sort of case where like maybe inside of here we jailbroke our iPhone. So things go as normal, like we run some program and things end up returning to whatever it's supposed to return to, but in the meantime, you manage to destroy the entire operating system. So you don't need to know like code concerning buffer overflows or actually like taking advantage of it. You do need to know like the basic ideas of this is the buffer that's being overflowed and this is the reason that it can be overflowed because we're not checking whether we're actually within the bounds of it.
The solution for preventing it is just checking the bounds.
Yeah, so in this case, the solution would be like, you could either say if strlen of bar is greater than 12 minus 1, because you need the backslash 0 at the end, or you could manually do like a for loop that only copies the first 11 characters, or just anything where you're actually checking to make sure you don't overflow that buffer. Other questions? Yes.
Can you talk about tries? Maybe some like the programming implementation.
Sure. So, which one? This one. Okay. So, the actual program, we would never make you do a implementation of a try on the exam because it would be unfair to those who did hash tables, and similarly, we would never make you implement a hash table on the exam because it'd be unfair to those who did tries. You should nevertheless know like the struct of a try or the struct of a hash table or whatever. That's actually true of any sort of data structure we've seen. So linked lists, stacks, queues, binary trees, you should be able to define those structs by heart. So try, that means the only thing you will need to do is like maybe we'll give you some word or something, and we'll say like construct the try that, or we'll give you maybe a set of words, and we're like construct a try that represents this dictionary. So let's make our dictionary cat and dog. So the idea of the try is we start out with this array, 26 slots. And in each slot, the actual index of the slot corresponds to the letter we're concerned with. So here, if we're trying to insert cat into our try, so the first character is C, which is going to be if A is 0, then B is 1, C is 2. So we're going to go into the second index. We're going to create a try off of that. We're just going to have 26 slots. And then we are going to index the second character of cat. So that's A, which is going to be the zeroth spot. And that's going to have 26 spots. So then we go to T, and we would also have that come down, which is actually kind of important because let's have it come up here. Here's our try for t. Let's say this is index t is 19. So the important thing to remember about tries is you can't just keep track of like these pointers. You also have to keep track of whether this is actually the end of the of a word. So inside of here, we need some kind of flag that says, okay, this is actually the end of a word. The reason being, if we let later try and insert catastrophic into our dictionary, which has the same starting three characters, but goes off further, we need to recognize that this is the end of a word. Or alternatively, if we try to look up CA, which maybe isn't a word, but we get down to here, then we, or would it be C, and then we look at A. So we need to recognize that even though there is a pointer coming out of this node, it doesn't represent the end of the word. So what does that mean? What are you gonna say? Oh, what does that mean our struct looks like?
It's an array of pointers that is 26 long, and then a bool word or not word.
Yeah, so we'll have struct try star pointers. So here we'll say 26. On and then the semicolon over here. But on the P set, we also needed to account for apostrophes, which meant you needed to like hard code that apostrophe was index 27 or something. But here we only care about 26. And then we need maybe a char, int, or bool. Let's call it is word. So that's two of the three things I think you would ever need to know about tries, building them, the struct of them. The last thing is the runtime of them. So what is the runtime of a try? Or, well, lookup in a try. Yeah, so this is where we say it's O of K, where K is the length of the word we happen to be looking up. But at the same time, we say, at least for pset 5, speller's sake, we say the longest word in the dictionary is 45 characters. So this is basically O of 45, which is constant time. So if there is an upper bound on your longest word, then, or even here, like the English dictionary, there is an upper bound on your longest word, or any dictionary. There is a longest bound on your upper word. So no matter what you do, it is constant time. But O of K is nice because, like, hey, there actually is a difference between running, say, a 45 character word versus an alphabet which only has words up to 3 characters. Another thing about that is that the because like just saying that 45 happens to be our longest word is kind of silly, because at the same time, like, let's say an algorithm is O of N. Well, okay, because memory only supports up to 2 to the 32 bytes, then N is at most 4 billion, that's constant time. Which is why at some point it's silly to say this sort of thing where there's an upper bound that we can just reduce to constant time, because everything is constant time when you think of it that way. But here we'd probably accept both of these. In any case, explain either that O of 1 means you have an upper bounded length of word, O of K means your length of the word, or well, K means length of the word. Yeah.
Because the Boolean, when you made your try, it seemed like it was, you would go C-A-T, and then you go to the next pointer, and then it would tell you if it was true. Would you put that true at, like, with the T, or would you have to point?
So let's think, this is the case where like a lot of examples you can just try and like come up with simple and or extreme examples and what it should be. So let's think of the word A. So in our original try, would we want to put it a 1 here, or would we want to put a 1 down here? So I would say that in the end, it could probably be either or. I can't think of a reason. Well, really, you wouldn't. All right, so the reason I wouldn't put it down there is because you don't even need to go that far. We never need to allocate this try. We just put the 1 up there. So like the end of the word, this is still pointing to null. But if we're only going to have single characters, there's no reason to extend down to another try just to mark that letter as used. So similarly, like if we had put the A down there, then necessarily all of these would just be 0 at all times.
But don't we need like sort of a starting try that will point to this A?
So we have some global or something, struct try star T, which points here, but that's just a pointer. It's not like a full-blown try that's pointing to it.
Okay. But that.
Do we have one boolean though? Like in the definition?
But what if you? Okay, so how would we assign the letter the word I?
So, his question might be answering that. Hold on. So, that is an issue, where a try in of itself. I don't know the way the pset would have written it. The previous struct was bad. But we could also do, let's say like struct node is a bool. And a pointer. There's actually multiple ways you could write it. Alternatively, try it doesn't need to be a struct. And even try that doesn't let you do that, does it? Node 26 is a try. And this is no longer struct. So now there's going to be I'm trying to think of the way the piece I would have expected you to.
Well, I pulled up like the review session, and I think they just go to if you have an A, then you go to the next.
That's how they do it.
And then there's a true there, it doesn't work.
Yeah, so that does work. It wastes the space of, like, you necessarily have a whole another level of try that you wouldn't need in the first place. Here it's getting ugly with each. Basically, what I'm trying to do here is associate, like, instead of being 26 pointers to new tries, it's 26, bool pointer, bool pointer, bool pointer, and so on. And yeah.
So you can't make like two arrays, like an array of booleans and an array of pointers?
So you could, but then you'd need to like two arrays of booleans and pointers. So you would need to then like build your array of booleans. Like your array of booleans needs to be as big as the try, because you can't just have 26 booleans. It has to grow with each possible. Like your try has more than 26 true or false possible words. So at that point, they may as well just be a single struct that your try goes down with. Why is this doesn't seem right? Because that, what do I want here? So try star T. Can you do? That might be the syntax I'm looking for. And this can just be a regular try. I'm not sure. But that is the way that we did it in the review, mm-hmm. So that works perfectly fine too. In which case, if it is just bool is word and then an array of 26, then you do have to go to the next level. I'll think about the way I would do that. Other questions?
Can I ask questions about something else?
Yes.
Can you go over what the difference is in when you'd use jQuery versus AJAX?
So they are, in and of themselves, completely different. jQuery does enable AJAX. It does give us some easier use of AJAX. But like AJAX comes shipped with JavaScript. JavaScript has AJAX capabilities. All AJAX means is like I'm already on a page, and when I click on something, like I don't need to reload the page to download that new information. I just request that new information. So you can look at it in say like Facebook or something. So network, shrink this. So down here, we see that we're getting all of these requests. Now when I click on like, or well, it's doing AJAX before I even click on anything. But if I click on like this, then it's gonna make a bunch of requests down here, which just making these requests. Oh, no one. Now it's over here. So let's refresh, do this again. We see that we get all these requests, but like this could still be in the process of the page loading. But notice Facebook is making these constant requests even after the page has loaded. And if I click on here, it'll make some more requests for some data that is in response to the thing I just clicked on. So that's just what AJAX is it lets you pull for data that wasn't downloaded with the page originally. So jQuery is separate. jQuery is just like, it is a JavaScript library that makes a lot of things easier. And I'll leave that. So with jQuery, it's a lot of the advantage is this just, I mean, dollar sign. So dollar sign is a valid variable in JavaScript. So jQuery, all it's doing is saying like var dollar sign equals a whole bunch of stuff. So like some big function with all this stuff in it. And then you use that dollar sign in ways like dollar sign footer, pick, let's say dot. Yeah, style, let's say like text align center. So jQuery gives us this sort of syntax where a big advantage of it has other features, but like what we want you to focus on most is just being able to select elements like this. So in regular plain old JavaScript, you could do things like document.getElementById footer dot, I don't know what it is at that point, something about CSS or style or something. So, but then alternatively, let's say we wanted to select by class. So now we are styling everything with a class footer with this style. Or even if we wanted to style any paragraphs. So this selector, being able to select things in the DOM like this is incredibly convenient, since in plain old JavaScript, you would have to do document.getElementsByClassName or whatever it is. Or if I wanted a tag, I'd need to say getElementsByTagName. So I need to know the specific ways that I access all of these things. The functions are going to be different depending on whether I'm using a class or an ID or a tag or what, whereas jQuery just does that for me.
So is jQuery going to be used when you're doing initial styling of the page or in order to change the styling after
it's already loaded?
To
change it.
After it's already loaded.
Yeah. It's any initial styling. Well, even the generally you would use this sort of change. You wouldn't like change, this would work perfectly fine. But usually you wouldn't change the style like this. Instead, you'd like give it a new class or something. Whereas the CSS has already been defined for that class in a certain way. So by giving this these items that I'm selecting a new class, I'm applying the styles that have already been downloaded.
So you like select a couple of checkboxes and the things that you've selected change to a new style.
Yeah.
Start looking different.
Yeah. So the other thing to remember about, well, there are several functions you should remember about jQuery. Let's say that we're selecting something with IDP. So
do you always have to use the pound?
So this means ID.
ID.
So it's equivalent to CSS. So CSS selectors, it's inspired by that. Where in CSS, if I wanted to style a footer or something with ID footer, it'd be like text align center. You won't need to write CSS on the exam, but like you need to know the selectors, you need to know what, you need to know how to read it. But you would never, you don't need to memorize like all of the different possible styling things or any of them. So jQuery, things you should remember, like .html. And a common pattern in jQuery, let's rewrite this. A common pattern is we have like $ hash f .html. So if I put just plain parentheses, that means get the HTML. Whereas if I say HTML and put whatever I want in here, some link to something, putting something inside of the parentheses now sets the HTML. So that's pretty common amongst a bunch of functions. There's the same deal with text. So the difference between HTML and text is that text is going to insert this as literal, like less than a greater than, instead of as a anchor tag. And text is going to be the same if I just do this. It's going to retrieve the text of the document, not the HTML of the document, but just the text within this, or within this element. Another one is if f happens to be an ID for an input, then hash f.val. So if I want to set the input to something, like let's say I hit a checkbox and then want to set a default value, so like .val, I don't even know, 3. So that will automatically insert into the text box 3. But if I say .val, then that will retrieve whatever is currently in the text box for me. And this is useful for like form validation, where if, say, like I just want to make sure that they actually filled out all of the things. So one way of doing that is after I hit submit, it's inevitably sent to some page on the server. Like for us, it'd be PHP. And that would try and process the data. And it would say, oh, they didn't fill something out. So now that redirects them to another page that says, oh, you didn't fill everything out. But instead of having to do that, instead in JavaScript slash jQuery, you can check just see is val empty, or is val empty quotes. So that's gonna just, now we can alert them, you didn't fill out this field. So inevitably you do need to do the PHP server-side checking, because you can just disable JavaScript in all browsers. But JavaScript makes it convenient for those who do have it activated. And I mean, virtually 99 point something percent of browsers have it on nowadays. Very few people turn JavaScript off. So it is a user convenience. You need to do PHP validation. You should do JavaScript validation. Yeah.
What does poundf refer to here?
What does poundf refer to? There is some element in my document with IDF. We look at probably Facebook has plenty of examples where if I come to elements, looking here under the elements tag, I see like this particular div that's being highlighted up here, or is it the whole page? Yeah, it's up there. So this has ID page ULAR. So in console, I'm assuming they're using jQuery. Yeah, so I could select pagelet, what was it, pagelet blue bar? Pagelet blue bar. Blue bar. So that selects that, and I did something wrong. Let's try, I don't know, let me know. Or maybe they aren't using jQuery and that character is mapped to something else. Area. Okay, better example in something I know is using jQuery. So looking at our elements here, we have say, here's class equals navbar. So this is something with class navbar. So inside of our console, we can look up the thing with class navbar. So here we can like scroll over this and see that's what this is. If I wanted to do dot text, this is the text of that. So I see like settings, report a bug, log out, which are all like under here, but that's still text within that HTML tag. I could set the HTML to just some link. Quotes. So I'll get rid of my var. Now that got rid of the header entirely, just set it to link to YouTube. And then is there any form example? So here's a form. I can right click and inspect element to come to it right here. I see that its ID is text search. So down here, if I do ID text search, so hovering over it, I see that that is the correct thing I was searching for. If I wanted to do dot val, it would give me what I had typed there. I wanted to do hello, it'll change it up here to hello jQuery. Of course, I could do ridiculous like document.getElementById, text search, I don't even know what it is at this point, dot value. No. Oh, I forgot that guy. So that's hello. I don't know how I'd set it. Equals something? Yeah, so that changed that. But you don't need to use these. And very many websites at this point use jQuery. So usually, even like on a final project, if you're doing a web project, the first thing I recommend is just including jQuery. So you can just get the convenience of all of these functions. Yeah.
I think I saw a different way to like get to a element using DOM. Do you have to like use dot and then keep going down?
So you can do that. I don't know if it would work very well. It's difficult to navigate that way.
Mm-hmm.
So like one example is, I don't even know if we have any forms, but like document.forms is going to return the list of forms that's on this page. Then I can do like document.forms. Zero, it's going to be the first form, dot, I don't know what we've called that. So it doesn't even have a name. So maybe inputs will work? No. I don't even know how to get at this. Might get element spy tag name input. Yeah, so that gave me the input. And now I want the zeroth input, and I want to select its value. So that's gonna give me text. So I had to end up doing get element by tag name anyway. There might be some way to select it directly through form zero. But the nice thing about this is still, like, I only had to get the tags called input that were a child of this form. Otherwise, if I just did that straight up front, this would select all elements on the entire page in the entire document instead of just that form. Probably won't even be the one I want. I don't even know which one it is. I don't know. I guess the first input element on our page is this little checkbox.
This is pretty unrelated and possibly kind of silly, but on the answer keys, it says that PHP, or I don't know whether it's answer key or notes, but it says PHP is the server side and JavaScript is client side. What exactly is the difference between the two?
So difference between JavaScript server client side, PHP server side. So if you have heard of slash used Node.js before, you would think that JavaScript isn't just client-side. But for CS50 purposes, it is, or at least for this quiz's purposes, it is. PHP being server-side. So like, no JavaScript, when you write your web page, you will be writing PHP on the server. You will never be writing JavaScript on the server. JavaScript ends up getting sent to the browser where the JavaScript code executes. And the JavaScript code needs to live in the browser, because otherwise, when I want to like just do any sort of JavaScripty thing, like clicking on this, I'm not reloading a page. This is just JavaScript reformatting things for me. So if JavaScript lived on the server, then I would need to inevitably request something of the server to know what to do. PHP, there is no such thing as PHP in the browser. It's when I request a page, so let's say here I requested this particular page. So that means that this is going to request, refresh. It's going to refresh this page. So this request goes out to my server. It sees that it needs to return this particular thread with this particular ID. So now that's going to be some PHP. That the PHP interpreter is going to interpret that page and transform it into just HTML, CSS, maybe JavaScript, whatever. So it's PHP that processes this request and retrieves all of like the text and stuff that I'm actually looking for from the database. But what leaves the server is just HTML. Slash JS slash CSS. There is no PHP which leaves a server, because if it actually did, then the browser would have no idea what to do with it, because that doesn't know what PHP is. But in the same thought, because JavaScript is client-side, you can never access MySQL from it. Because PHP is server-side, you do access MySQL from it. Yeah.
Can you go over some of the security concerns with cookies?
So those are not things we're going to need to know. Some of the security concerns with cookies and HTTP. So the big question here is, we see here that my cookie is PHP sesh ID. So that's like the universal PHP, your session. So your session is something that inside of PHP will never need to be validated, because it's the server that has complete control over the session. You can't touch it at all. But it's this cookie, this one, and I guess you could log in as me right now if you wanted to use that. But it's that cookie that the like inevitably you make a single request to the server. The server returns the page. The request is done. It no longer has any idea who you are. So the next request you make is going to include that cookie so that it knows, oh, this is the person who made this request before. This is the session data that is associated with this user. So that's why you don't have to log in for each and every page you use. The security issue here is that that cookie is sent out just over the web. There's no, we're using HTTPS here. So in this case, that means that we are encrypting this stuff. So someone can't come in and just steal my cookie and now the server will think they're me. But with straight HTTP, they can't. Just like this Wireshark, Firesheep stuff that you can just listen to all of the Wi-Fis in the air and intercept whatever you want. So, yeah.
Yeah, a sort of similar security risk is like storing user IDs in post, because that can be freely edited using consoles and things.
Yes, so there's plenty of issues where like just anything that comes from the user, you need to validate. Like, if you, there are plenty of cases where it would be useful for like, I'm about to make a post, blah, 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 blah. Then I hit reply. So it would be very useful if the post request included my ID, because like, I want to associate this post with me. But I can't do that because I am free to make a post request. I just like manually come up with my own post request that uses your user ID, and now it will post as you. So that's why server side, I can't rely on post requests containing the correct user ID. That's why it has to belong in like session. So I look up your user ID in my session array, and I insert that into my database as the user who actually made this post.
And that's based on your cookie?
Yeah. So it uses the cookie to match up you as the user who made that request. It pulls out the user ID from that session, and that's then inserts into the database using that user ID. So this like button, what that's actually doing is, I'm not going to find it here. It's going to be Ajax function. What is Ajax function? Find out what job my JavaScript is sources. It was a CS50 project a while ago. I can't remember what it is. But so Ajax function, all Ajax function is doing is making an Ajax request to a page with this ID, with the ID 22453. It's not even a post request, it's a get request, which makes it even easier so that if I knew what the URL is, it's something like this slash ID equals 22453, or question mark ID equals 22453. So visiting this URL will like that, which wouldn't be as much of a problem, but it's incredibly easy to write a loop which is just going to visit this URL over and over again, which is why you see I Saw You Harvard posts with thousands of things. And they tend to be CS50 based I Saw You Harvard posts. How do I find the most liked? They tend to get deleted pretty quickly too. This is not the most liked. There we go. So cheaters on the most liked page, that's pretty relevant to this right now. Yeah, oh wow, they've already deleted any of the ones from this year which have been cheated on. Those have all been deleted. But yeah, there will never be a post that gets this high. This one was obviously cheated on to get onto the most liked page. More questions?
What should we know about XHTML?
Virtually nothing, just like what it is. The difference between it and HTML being that, like, so XML is very similar in appearance to HTML, except So in HTML, we just happen to have a predefined set of tags. But with XML, XML is just like a general format where you can make an XML document for whatever purposes you want. So for example, if I wanted, I could construct like an XML for the courses, and I actually think that CS50 has an API for this. So my XML document could look something like courses, and of course I need some end courses. I could have a course, and it could have, say, like name equals CS50, and then my end course. And I could put inside of here like students, and then inside of students, I have like a list of one student whose name is whatever, and I end that student, and so on. So I just happen to have constructed some arbitrary XML document, but it is valid XML. So XML, all it is this sort of structure. And the nice thing, the reason like that we even call it XML, is that this sort of thing is very easy to parse. So like it's very easy to take this document and make an array out of it. And so XHTML is an attempt to get HTML to be valid XML. So already this looks pretty similar to HTML. Some of the differences are like HTML, you are able to do things like input, maybe type equals text, which is the default, so I don't need to say that. Disabled. So there are two things in here that make this invalid XHTML. The first thing is that all XML tags need a closing tag. So in the case of input, I need to do which direction of slash is it? This direction? That looks wrong. Other direction. So self-closing tag. The second thing is that with XML, you need these sorts of like key value pairs. It needs a value associated with it. So even though disabled in and of itself expresses what I want, this input should be disabled, that's invalid XHTML. What I actually need to write is like disabled equals disabled. So now it's valid XHTML. And these are just these slight differences that transform it from HTML to an XML-based sort of thing. Yeah?
If XML is about like altering your own text altogether, like why is it so extensively used as opposed to CSV files or...
So the think of like a CSV. So a CSV, you have just values separated by, I mean, just think of a spreadsheet. So a CSV is basically a spreadsheet. You have maybe columns, and you have a bunch of rows that associate data with those columns, but that's it. XML is much more versatile in that like you have an arbitrary hierarchy of data, and I could have multiple courses that have multiple students within it, whereas it'd be difficult to think of a spreadsheet that like just that single spreadsheet, CSV especially, like is just a single spreadsheet. So that single spreadsheet having all CS50, 51, 61, and then within those, all of the students related to those times, maybe meeting times and all that sort of thing. The other thing is that the tag names give a nice like name to all of the elements. So reading a CSV file, it can be difficult to try and parse what it's actually seeing. XML is much more human readable. So that's why like come up to some person who doesn't really know what a CSV file is or like isn't a programmer or something. You can give them like a template XML file and they can follow the lines and like, oh, I'm supposed to insert my name here. So it's a much more usable format. CSV has plenty of uses, but XML has different uses. More questions? Other questions?
From the previous quiz, where vertical scaling versus horizontal scaling?
You would not need to know that. I don't think we even discussed that.
Okay.
I'm guessing it was just a one-off comment. In horizontal versus vertical scaling is not something you'll need to know. I think the difference is just like, the answer key will say the difference. That vertical scaling is just like, my computer's doing poorly, I'll get a better one. Whereas horizontal scaling is, my computer is doing poorly, let me get 20 of them to all work on the same task. Yeah.
Can we go like the linked list way of making queues?
Sure. So that's easier than the array way. The linked list way of making queues. So first, what does our struct for linked list look like? I'll type def it.
Are we doing it for?
Let's
like
do
ints.
Yeah.
A value and a pointer to the next.
Yeah. So int val, and then struct. Node star next. So that's what we'll use for the example here. Let's actually type up this stuff. Here. Okay. So let's do list. So our struct. Now, looking at our queue, we have the, let's just make a global queue. It'll be node star queue. And we have a dequeue function. I guess these things could also return true or false, or let's do that. So bool dequeue, and we're dequeuing, int dequeue, what did we do with this before? Int dequeue, and we have bool enqueue, and we need to enqueue some integer. So let's do enqueue first. So we have our queue. We want to insert something into the queue. What is the best way to do that? So over here, our queue currently looks like we have some global pointer to the start. There's our queue. Now, assuming that we dequeue by taking the first element, where are we going to want to insert our node so that queues work as they should?
Very good.
Yeah. So queues are supposed to be last or first in, first out, which means that the new element should be inserted over here. Okay. So coming back to code, that means that we will want to loop over our queue. So let's do node star current equals queue. So while current does not equal null, let's do it separately. So first current equals queue. So what do we do if current starts off as null? Do this two ways, first this way. What do we do if current is null? So this is equivalent to if queue is null. So should we return false? What's wrong with inserting something into an empty list?
Nothing's wrong with that, sorry.
Yeah, so here, the only difference is my global queue is being sent to my new node. have to do my checks of if Q is null, return false. So that's what I do. Oh, and then Q val equals I, Q next equals null, return true. Okay, so I'm gonna jump the gun right here. And remember what we did that last time, where we said it was much easier to work with node star stars with this sort of thing. So now current is going to be and Q. And coming down to here, while current, while star current does not equal null. So let me just do current. Talk about this in a second. Current next. Okay. So looking at it this way, this is iterating over all of my pointers until I reach a null pointer. The null pointer is going to be the pointer I want to replace with my new node. So looking at iPad version, if my original pointer is null, the linked list is empty, then current is going to point here. This is going to point to null. So this is the pointer I end up moving to point to some other new node. Whereas if the example is this case up here, then current is going to traverse from here. I messed up slightly, where current is supposed to be the address of current next. Is that what I want? Current, so star current, gives me a node. Next traverses to the next one. So over here. So I'm currently pointing here. Let's do red. So I'm currently pointing here. Then star current is going to reference this node. Star current next references this node, but that's not what I want. I want this pointer. That node. So that pointer to this node is ampersand star current next. So at this point in time, I've officially reached the node that I want to replace. So let's replace all of these Qs. Current. And now we're done. So maybe typos, but the idea is that with insert in this sort of way, it is easier to work with the pointers that we want to change instead of needing to keep track of, like, okay, is my start null? Oh, it is, then I need to create the start node to be something specific. Else, I want to iterate until the next thing I point to is null, and then I'll replace that, what the next thing is, to my malloc node. So instead of needing to separate those cases, here I only need to deal with the case of what is the pointer that is null that I no longer want to be null, and that makes life easier, except these should all be star current now. Because.
Are they still the size of a node?
Yes. So I'm still mallocing a node.
Is it going to be the size of a node star?
So the. Come back to here. Think of the case if this is our linked list, then, well, new linked list. So this guy points off to null. After that while loop, current points to here. Because this is the pointer that is null. So now I want to change this pointer to point to a new node. So first, I malloc that new node. So malloc size of node. and that returns a node star. And now changing this pointer is equivalent to star current equals this new node that I allocated. So if current is a node star star, then star current is going to be a node star. And if I'm mallocing something of size of node, then this is returning a pointer to a node. So this is a node star. So both sides correctly have the same type. And so if what I just allocated was null, return false, else finish setting them to what I want them to be. Except these need parentheses because that's not how the order of things work. Without the parentheses, that was being interpreted as current arrow val, dereference that. Instead, I want to dereference current, which brings me to a node. Then I want to get the value associated with that node.
I thought arrows allowed you to bypass that and go straight to the value.
They do. So that's if I have, let's say Q as an example. I'm allowed to do Q arrow val equals I, because Q is a node star.
Okay.
If I do, if there were some nice syntax of like current longer arrow val or something, which referenced or did two D references, then this would work well.
So the arrow is only for one D reference.
Yeah. Alternatively, I could write this as star star current dot val. Just like I could also write Q as star Q dot val. So that's insert. Or well, that's in Q, I guess. DQ is going to be significantly shorter. So let's put void in here for cleanliness. So DQ, what element am I DQing?
First one.
Yeah. So if my first one is null, return, I don't know what we want, George, int max. And then you should do a check to see if int max was returned. That's the sort of thing that like get int does. Else we want to, so can we just return q val? Is that what we want to do? So DQ also implicitly removes the item from the queue. So let's first say, let's get a temp to point to the first node of our queue. Now we want to advance our queue to point to the next thing in the queue. Now we have temp left. Temp val is the thing we want to return. So val equals temp val. But before we return it, we should free temp and return val. So the order of operations here is important in that we need to grab a temp before we move Q to the next element. We need to get the value before we free temp, and then we can return the val.
Should we set the Q to Q next?
Yes. That was creating a bad loop. Slash, it wouldn't work after freeing it anyway. Q equals Q next. We want to advance the Q to the next element, not advance the next element to what the element currently is. Stacks would be significantly even easier in that DQ is exactly the same because we're pulling off the front of the stack. NQ would be very similar, where we just want to allocate a node and insert into the front of the stack. So we don't even need to loop over anything. We just insert directly at the front. Everyone good on that? Okay, more questions? So the most recent lecture, You do not need to know any code. You should know the overarching ideas. So, well, Nate's half didn't have any code, so those slides are online and just like look at them, and they have the major ideas. My half, like knowing the overall idea of like, well, first you can't trust anything. The fact that like maybe the process of the compiler can be bad, but it doesn't even matter that like the source code looks fine because the compiler might be specifically altered to change the source code in the process of compiling. Same time, just like, I think those are like the major ideas of it.
So, did you mention that we don't need to know anything really about FireSheep, or do we need to know that?
So with Nate's half of things, anything that Nate touched on, like FireSheep, Wireshark, I don't even think he did FireSheep in detail. Mm-hmm. Or you also did something with that. Was it FireSheep last week? Did you touch on that?
Yeah,
so we're not going to give you like FireSheep output and say like interpret this. It's just going to be, it would be a question like, what is FireSheep? What is it used for?
It only works on version 4 of Firefox or something.
It might be broken by now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no idea. They don't seem to have disabled it manually, but maybe it doesn't work with the most recent Firefox.
I should try installing this, it would be compatible.
Ah. So I guess it doesn't work with the most recent Firefox. But the idea still stands of what it was meant to show. It was absurd how much of the world was not living in HTTPS at the time. Like, even in the last 2 years or whatever, it's still, there's a dramatic improvement in the number of websites which use HTTPS.
Do you need to go over HTTP?
The protocol of it, or?
I mean, like, some of the things we should know.
All right, so, I mean, basic things are everything you can see in your network tab. So when I request a page, coming back up to the top for the main things, you can see here the requests that I make. So Chrome happens to format it all nicely for us, where the request URL was this, the request method was get, and the status code was 200 okay. If I hit view source, I see more directly that, and this is this either, we could show you either of these, but it isn't too difficult to interpret between them. So here is the direct request I made. So this means that I went to apps.cs50.net/discuss/thread/inbox/all/1. And the protocol it used was HTTP/1.1, which is virtually, it's always going to be that. Over here, we used get. So this might also be post, and then coming down all the way down to response headers, if we view that source, is where we see the 200 okay. Mm-hmm. So know the possible different status codes of these. Like, I think in the review we do say a couple of these. So like 403, 404, those kind of common ones. That's the major idea of it. The difference just between HTTP and HTTPS is this encryption.
Are you done?
Okay. I think so. Well, yeah.
Could you like talk very generally about how encryption works? Because we talked, for example, when compressing Huffman files, you know how to decompress them because you actually sent the table, the hash table within the file. So how does encryption work how do you know how to decrypt information if you haven't actually sent the client the key to the, and actually you can actually grab that key from?
Yes.
How does the general process work?
So the general process of encryption, that is an incredibly detailed question of answer. There is a short, Tommy and I made the short. Unfortunately, it is like 26 minutes. So it is not a short, it is a long. But our short was on RSA, which is just one example of these. And this RSA is part of the overall HTTPS protocol. So the idea, RSA is an example of public key cryptography, which means you have two separate keys. Use one key to actually encrypt things and use another key to decrypt things. So this key that you use to encrypt things is the one that's public. So the website can send you this encryption key, and they use that, they do send you that encryption key, and when you want to send something back to them, you use that encryption key to encrypt all of your data and send it to them. So they're the only ones with the private key. If that private key became known, then anyone would be able to decrypt your data. But that private key, which is mathematically related to the public key, but you cannot figure one out from the other. So that private key can be used to decrypt the data. Since they're the only ones with the private key, they're the only ones who can read the data. And it's, so like, even though the public key is public, so I use the same, when I go to google.com or whatever, they might have multiple, I don't know. But if I go to google.com, he goes to google.com, she goes to google.com, we all can use the same public key to encrypt our own information to be, or however we want, but none of us are going to be able to figure out, are going to be able to decrypt their information because the public key isn't able to decrypt. It can only encrypt. And it's fun/detailed math of just like a bunch of modulo operators and exponentials and stuff. That it just works out that the private key is the only thing that can decrypt the public key's encryption stuff. Yeah. The RSA short for more details.
Is that on the website?
Yeah, I think it is at this point. Or at least, I think a YouTube link to it was posted, so. Let's see. Shorts. I think it would have been week two related. Yeah, RSA. And it is, we're not gonna play this, 24 minutes. So it's a long one. More questions?
Could you talk briefly about Fitbit masks?
Sure, so briefly, the idea is just that like.
What is it, Rob?
Bit masks. So the idea is that like, let's just say we have some, we're using an integer. So int x. So start off at 0. So now this integer is 32 bits. So any single one of those bits can be used to represent a specific flag. So this is where if you look at like operating system codes, they use this all over the place, where maybe up top somewhere they like hash define, say like, let's see some examples. So man to open. Yeah, so the open system call, we can see here that it one of its arguments is int flags, which what it expects as that argument are some of these flags. We see O append, O async, O clo exec, O create, and so on, O direct. So these sorts of flags are hash defined somewhere, and all of them are exactly one bit. So like O create might be hash defined as 1 left shift 4. And so that's gonna be the, whenever I use OCREAT, that's just going to be like in binary, 1000 and 30-ish zeros before it. So only a single bit is set. And that bit represents this flag. And so any other flag, no other flag is gonna be left shifted by 4. So I'm able to represent up to 32 flags in a single integer by doing, say, like, x equals OCREAT bitwise or ODirect. So you're just picking any two of those flags. Now, x is going to have 2 bits set, which correspond to the two bits of OCREAT and ODirect. The way that then, so then we pass x into the open function. And open needs to see what flags were actually set. So that's where it's going to do things like, if x bitwise and OCREAT do something, or if x and ODirect do something else, and then there may be some flag that we didn't have set, if x and O, I don't know what the other flags were. So that particular condition is not going to be executed, or that block of code is not going to be executed, but these two are because those two flags were set. And notice that, like, so in C, any value that is not 0 is true. So x and OCREAT will be either 0 or OCREAT, because OCREAT only has a single bit set. If that bit is set in x, then this is going to return OCREAT, the binary where just that bit is set. If that bit in x is not set, then it's going to return 0, in which case we know the flag was not set. So that's how you use bit masks. I think on a previous exam or maybe in class or something, like, you can also use bit masks to, like, print out the binary of a variable. So I can use, say, or well, looping over like 1 left shift 0, and then print if x and that, if x and 1 left shift 0, then print a 0 or 1, or print a 1, else print a 0. And then I go over once more. If x and 1 left shift 2, then that means that the second bit of the variable is set, so I print a 1, else I print a 0. And I think we might actually want to do that in the reverse order, because usually you want, like, the left side to be the highest order bits and the right side to be the lowest order bits. So I'll probably loop like 4 int I equals 31 until I hit 0. Then do that sort of just that exact condition, if x and 1 left shift I, print 1 else 0.
Thank you.
I think we're out of time. Any more questions in the last couple out of time seconds? All right, good luck tomorrow. This was the last section where next week's going to be optional. I'll, like, give back quizzes and we can go over them and maybe go over other things that you are interested in, or final project things or future CS classes things, I don't know. But this is the last material filled section. Bye.